Someone sent me a forward on what the enlightened husband says. He says, I do exactly what the voices in my wife's head tell her to tell me to do. Living that understanding in each and every relationship of ours is living the teaching. When there is a total and complete acceptance that everyone has been designed by God to think precisely the way they think, based on their conditioning, the way their parents treated them, their economic background, their social background, their religion, and their genetics. When this complete and total acceptance is there that everyone is an instrument created by the divine, you no longer assign this deep sting of doership to people. You did this to me, and I did this to you. Because the same divine which has created them has created you. So you live the teaching with the complete understanding that everything happens precisely the way it is meant to, and everyone is an instrument through whom the same consciousness functions. So your relationship switches from being with individuals with a sense of doership to a relationship with the divine. And things start getting viewed more as a happening through someone rather than their doing. The whole dynamic of the relationship changes. You know, Joan of Arc, when she was put on trial, she said precisely the same thing. See, this young girl was put on trial for winning the war for her country and liberating her country. And the British put her on trial in connivance with the French. Now, she was led by the divine voice of the Archangel Michael when she was a young girl in the village. And the voice told her that there's a sword lying for you in the temple church. You pick it up and just go and meet the reigning prince and tell him you are here to help him free France. Or something to that effect. Now, in the trial, they are trying to brand her a witch. So the inquisitors tell her that all this thing you made up, these voices in your head, you made up. Where could you hear these voices? They are all in your head only. It's not like the divine has come and spoken to you. And her reply as a young girl was, but sir, if I didn't hear them in my head, where else would I hear them? Which means that she was led to do precisely what the divine intended her to do. Outside, inside, these are all irrelevant. What is there outside? There is nothing truly outside. If you just close your eyes, whatever comes up, be it the sound of the rain, be it a thought, it's all happening in your consciousness. So where is the question of outside? Everything is happening within your consciousness. There is no outside. If hate arises, it's happening within your consciousness. There is no outside. Everything is inside, within the sphere of consciousness. When this is realized and lived, this split between me and the other, between subject and object, that starts standing on very shaky ground. You realize that that way of seeing is the split mind. Me versus the other. And the truth is me and the other. And then all these notions of blame, condemnation, hate, malice, jealousy, envy, guilt, pride, arrogance start coming crumbling down. The walls of the fortress which have been built by this separation start coming crumbling down. And what happens more and more is an acceptance of what is. In daily living. Pleasure or pain. I never read much of Krishnamurti, but in Ganeshan ji's book, which I'm reading now, he is the grandnephew of Ramana Maharshi. So when I met him in December, he had given me his book, which had come out newly then. He mentioned two quotations of Krishnamurti which are so clear and sum up exactly this very teaching. I'll read them out. Freedom is not a reaction. It is not a choice. It is man's pretense that because he has choice, he is free. Freedom is pure observation without direction, without fear of punishment and reward. Freedom is pure observation without direction. Freedom is without motive. Freedom is not at the end of the evolution of man, but lies in the very first step of his existence. In observation, one begins to discover the lack of freedom. Freedom is found in the choiceless awareness of our daily existence. Choiceless awareness of our daily existence. Which is the I am of Nisargadatta Maharaj. Abide in your beingness. Just be. And choiceless awareness is the acceptance of what is. There is no longer me with its sense of doership trying to change situations to its benefit. First, there is the complete acceptance of what is. So much of our suffering is that we convert the what is to what should be according to our limited intellect and understanding. Then we start living more and more the thy will be done. Is lived more and more. If something is taken away from you, there is the understanding this could have happened only if it was God's will. Thy will be done. And when this is lived, the thinking mind starts getting disengaged. All that enormous space taken up by the overactive thinking mind, going into an imaginary future, delving into a dead past, it just stops doing that. and the space which is created is the space which was already there, which is the space of being. And then all the hard positions we have taken in life, the next thought which comes up is, does this really matter? Does this truly, really matter? It's going to come and go, fleeting. Is it real? It didn't matter to you in deep sleep. Does it really matter? And that is the journey to peace of mind in daily living. Not sitting in meditation for 2 hours a day. Someone I met yesterday said that her preference is for meditating 3 hours a day. Because the first hour she takes for her mind to quieten down, the second hour is when she is aware that the mind has quietened down, and the third hour is when she goes very deep into meditation. So then I asked her, but then why don't you add one more hour and see where that goes? Not in a demeaning way. What I was trying to say is, any teaching must be lived from morning to evening, not just as a practice. That is why people who are drawn to Jnana Yoga are sometimes criticized that they don't want to make the effort, they don't want to practice some technique. But that is a misunderstanding. Because truly, Jnana Yoga itself is a practice in that sense of being aware. Being in the I am, not being done by someone, but living the teaching is where you will see the most benefits. Because there is no point being restricted to a practice which gives you tremendous peace and joy, but the rest of your life is a mess. Your relationships are a mess. Which would you prefer? Would you prefer sitting for 2 hours in samadhi and the rest of your waking state, your mind is in turmoil? And your suffering is intense? If God came to you and said, I will give you 2 fabulous hours of meditation, but the rest of your waking state is going to be really terrible, would you take it? Or if he said that you will be blessed with peace of mind in daily living, but you may not be sitting for 2 hours in meditation, which would you take? Because living the teaching is the meditation being sought. What is being sought is the absence of the me with its sense of doership, which is living the teaching. And a deep taste of that comes in meditation, but should not get restricted just to the practice. You could be a yogi with fabulous achievements. I know some. Can't imagine the things they have achieved. Really, I mean, astonishing. But their relationships with their own families are horrific. And we really hesitate to be alone. So many people don't like being alone. It is natural. But to take some time off for oneself is something beautiful one can do. You know, as Sadhguru Jaggi Vasudev said, that if you don't like being alone, that means you're not in very good company. Because when you're alone, there's no one else around you whom you're deriving your sense of self from. This mask which we wear all the time with others, there's no need to wear that mask when you're alone. Someone asked a sage that I don't like being alone, what should I do? So he said, very simple. Go to the cinema hall for the late night show of a horror movie, watch it, and when you come out, I guarantee you, you will feel there's someone behind you all the time. Practical. But what is that which is behind all the time? Consciousness. Your sense of being, which you have covered up with thinking, doing, and becoming. So how could you be alone? If you are resting in your sense of being, which is the I am, who is left to be alone? Can we at least acknowledge our sense of being? Or is it such a burden to be that all the time we are thinking of what should I do, how should I occupy myself, whom should I meet now? How come these thoughts don't come in deep sleep? We have made silence our enemy, because in silence there is no me, but we are too afraid to be absent. What will happen to me? So the thinking mind starts building all these cartwheels of lateral thinking, vertical thinking, horizontal thinking, in-depth thinking, outward thinking, because the me derives its sense of self. This is who I am. This is me. The mind becomes overactive. Then the mind is not silent. And it is unconscious suffering. We don't realize it. We lose so much of the present moment when that is going on. I had gone out for dinner with a couple about a week ago, and the girl has a very active mind, you know, but to the degree that if one says something, like if she asked me which floor I stayed on and I said second floor, and in a minute she would say, which floor do you stay on? I'd say second floor. So the husband said, look here, you just asked him this question a minute ago. Now this started happening pretty often in the conversation. So of course the mind is overactive because it's not absorbing the information coming its way, because it is fragmented. With what? With thinking, which is the nature of the mind. It is the way her mind has been conditioned. It is not a deliberate doing on her part. But at some point, the realization will dawn, whenever it is meant to. that my thinking is taking me away from myself, my true self. And thoughts are objects in the mind. Your relationship with objects in your environment is a reflection of the thinking mind, your relationship with them. Your attachment to them. Do you derive your sense of self from objects? What kind of objects? Why is it that in ashrams all the rooms are sparse? Why are they not full of curios and things? Can get that? Beautiful. Is that on camera? Next time I'll know when everyone is looking not at me, what's going on. Otherwise I might think it's so boring for them that they're looking out of the window. Doesn't need to. Ramana Maharshi's relationship with animals was so beautiful. It is, especially I remember the story about the crow which was on the lamppost for 3 days just sitting there till someone brought it to the Maharshi's notice. And then he brought it down and I think fed it some water and then it died in his palms. That was it. And then they've made a samadhi for the crow. That is a felt oneness with being. Even Francis of Assisi was known to be someone who drew all the animals and birds to him.
Yeah, Dr. Prakash Amte.
Uh-huh.
Work, sir. Stayed with many animals, including wild animals.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to stay with wild animals, but...
But he is absolutely reacting naturally with them.
Exactly.
And people who come to visit his place, they are mortally afraid.
Where is this?
Himalakasam. Himalakasam.
Sorry?
Gachiroli.
You've been there?
I have not been there. I have seen that in a film. There was a film on Dr. Prakash Hampi.
Recently a squirrel has started coming. So I looked up the symbology of squirrels on the net. So it says the squirrel is fun-loving and doesn't take life too seriously. Just Google it, you'll find that.
It forgets its food.
Yeah. It keeps many things in its nest or hole, but remembers only one or two things.
It buries the nuts and you get trees growing out of that.
Amazing. Nature can be so therapeutic. For us it is even the rains in a city like Bombay. Of course to commute it's difficult. That is why few people have come today. But I remember once in Vancouver we had gone to attend one of Eckhart's early retreats in an island called Hollyhock. So we were walking, a group of us, through the forest, and he was saying generally how nature does not have a thinking mind. So when we are in nature, the reason we feel so good is because that vibration which is there, let's say in a city. Can you imagine the number of thinking minds in Bombay? So that is not the vibrational pool of a forest. That itself is so healing. And we were walking through and there was this huge, they have these very tall trees, I don't know what their names are. So one of them had fallen. So he said, look at that, what is that? So I said, seems to be a fallen tree. And he said, like, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to make it. I said, no, it's a dead tree now. So he looked at me and he said, form dissolving. Form dissolving. The form of the tree is dissolving. And that is the nature of forms. Forms dissolve. Every night when you sleep, they have dissolved. Everything dissolves into that silence. All your fears, your hopes, your aspirations, your ambitions, your likes, your dislikes, dissolve. That is how real they are. Yet we cling on to them. Isn't it amazing that we are so programmed to clinging on to forms which dissolve? It reminds me of, I think in the Buddha's sword I had written about the tourist who visits the Sufi sage and he sees the room is completely bare and the sage is sitting in the middle. So the tourist asks the sage, where's all your furniture? So the sage replies, but where's yours? So the tourist says, but I'm a tourist, I'm traveling, and the Sufi sage says, so am I. You liked it. And furniture is not just furniture. Furniture is the furniture here. How much furniture is here? How many chests of drawers which you haven't opened up for years? How many dusty lamps? How much junk has been collected of concepts, feelings, emotions? We have a full-blown IKEA department store here, huh? Buddha, you've come after a long time.
Yeah, last time. I was completely forgot.
All well? Some of y'all bring fruits and cakes and leave it in the kitchen and y'all think I won't find out, huh? Who's brought what? Thank you. When people would get Ramana Maharshi food, no? He'd say, if you get for everyone, then I'll have it, not just for me.
Ambitious to ask for scald water, sir.
Anand, I enjoyed your last essay very much.
Thanks.
It was a really good one. About that man who through circumstances
after a lot of time was told that he's still alive.
Okay. Roshni, you managed to come in this rain?
I was in the temple only.
Yeah.
So, it's just 20 minutes.
Okay. How are you?
I'm good.
So, Rishi?
Yes.
How are you doing?
Good.
You have one of the seven Rishis in our living room today. Which one? Sapta Rishis. Indian names are so beautiful, yeah. We have an Anand here. We have Anoop here. We have Ashwini here. Asha, Hope. Amazing, no? I think Indian names are so beautiful. What does Vanaja mean?
One in the forest.
Arey, look at that. Wah, wah, wah.
Gautam is also a Rishi.
Yes, I believe so. Yeah.
Apart from Buddha.
I told you all about when many years ago at Ramesh's place, no, someone, a foreigner, asked me my name. So I said Gautam, and excuse me, and I said Gautam, excuse me. So she wasn't getting the name. So I said, now how to explain it? So I said, have you heard of the Buddha? So she said, no. So I said, okay, have you heard of Gotham City? She said, yes. I said, okay. Whatever works. Oh man, I've had such fun times there. And once I remember it was, in the early days, we had to stand down, and then at a certain time, the signal was given, and everyone would run up. you know, like a herd, like the wildebeest going on a stampede. So Sundays was the maximum crowd, because all the locals would be there on Sundays who were working. They could not go on other days. So it was a Sunday and the time was given, and we were younger, from the younger batch, so to speak. So we were like, we ran up fast, got our seat in the inside room. So I went and sat in my favorite spot, which was next to Rameshya. And one elderly lady, I would say about, at that time, she must have been 65 or so, and she was huffing and panting, but she came pretty fast. And I was really impressed, and she sat next to me. And she did, and she looked at me. She said, "These bloody Indians." And I'm like, I said, "Should I tell her something or no?" And I said, "I completely agree with you." This must have been in like 2001, 2002, around those years. When we were young.
I think probably in 94, 93, first of like, I think we just go out.
You had gone that long back?
Bulsakers.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Wow.
After Osho passed away, mom and mama and everyone still looking for some other satsangs.
Yes.
But the mom said, "Rishi, you have to come. You have to meet Bansi."
But you must have been so young then, yeah?
22.
Wow.
Yeah. That time, there was a lot of
ex-Osho. You're right. Because I remember even in the year 2000, when they would come, and Ramesh would begin by asking people their name, because he liked to know their background a bit, you know. So he'd say, "What is your name?" And let's say, Westerner would say that I am Ma Saraswati. So he would say, so he would look at her, and then he would say, "Passport name, passport name." That is really but early days, huh?
Achcha.
Yeah. You must have, when you were there, there must have been much fewer people, right?
Yeah. It's like this maybe one or two more.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
People would come.
So during my time there were at least about 35 to 45 people.
Oh.
Yeah.
You never had to be
35. Yeah. It was amazing to see, you know, the teaching just reaches out to all corners, all countries. Like Maharaj's attic, I mean Nisargadatta Maharaj in Khetwadi in a loft. No Google Maps, no Airbnbs, no net, no Facebook, no YouTube, but yet they would come. And that is all thanks to Morris Friedman, who translated I Am That, who was with Ramana Maharshi before, with Krishnamurti. He helped bring the Dalai Lama into India. And there's a very touching story of, in his old days, have you all read about this? Ganesan has spoken about this. In Morris Friedman's old days, and Maharaj considered Morris Friedman a jnani. So he was alone, so there was no one to look after him. I don't know the details of the story, but what happened was, this lady, like a caretaker, you know, she came to Morris Friedman to look after him. So she was asked, you know, that why did you come to look after this man? And she said, "I had a dream where a sage comes to me in a loincloth and tells me to go and look after this man. So that is why I have come. Otherwise, I had no intention to come." And then later on, she saw a photograph of the sage, and who was it?
Ramana
Maharshi. So see how compassionate the source is, you know. That is actually, I'm not doing justice to that story, but you'll try reading it up on the net. It's extremely beautiful that the source took care of someone like Morris Friedman this way. I'll tell you all something which happened with me, quite funny. Years ago, I was in Thiruvannamalai at the Ramana Ashram, and there's a bookstore across the road. It's called Bhagwan Arts. So I went there, we supply some of our books there. So he had requested me, he said, Robert Adams' book, Silence of the Heart. Robert Adams was an enlightened disciple of Ramana Maharshi in the West. So there's a book called Silence of the Heart. So this manager requested me that if you can publish it in India, it would be of great service to Robert Adams' fans and followers and devotees, because they really like that book and it's hard to get. So I said, see, by all means, because this is my passion also. So I said, I'll write to them, whoever's in charge. We'll try, we'll ask them if rights are available for India, and if it happens smoothly, I'm happy to do it. So I came back to Bombay and we wrote to the institute or something which looks after Robert Adams' work, and we got a reply some time later saying that we are not interested. So I was very relieved, because I felt, you know, as it is, these books one does not make money on. And the relief was not that. The relief was that we did what we had to. The universe requested it. Our duty was to ask. We asked. Unfortunately, it was a negative, which is fine. Now it's settled. And about 3 days later, I remember it was about 3:34 in the afternoon, I got a call from the States. So, and on the other end of the line was Nicole Adams, Robert Adams' wife. She was old then, so now I think she must be really old. So she said, are you Gautam? And I said, yes. And she said, have you written to us recently about, you know, publishing this book in India? I said, yes, ma'am, we did, but unfortunately, your institute felt it's not appropriate, so we've let the matter rest there. So she said, I must tell you something. She said, I was woken up by Robert at 3:30 in the morning. This is, of course, after Robert passed away. Huh? And Robert told me, why are you not giving the rights to that young Indian man? So then she sent the contract, and I told her, I said, ma'am, we can't afford a big royalty advance for these kind of books. We normally tend to go out of pocket also sometimes. She said, don't worry, put something down, because that's part of our procedure. Whatever it be, you write it down, you send it, I'll sign the contract, and it'll be done. And that is how we published Silence of the Heart in India. It's a lovely book.
This is very beautiful talk, Robert Adams on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.